So I don't have a scientific study to back this up, but it's my firm belief that every parent has a story of losing their child for a moment, right? So you're at the fair, at the grocery store, somewhere at the park, right? Now, my daughter Zora is only a year old. She's just mastering the walking stage, so I don't have as many stories of my own yet. But if I'm honest with you, this church is a safe space, right? There are moments when I'm out in the foyer and Zora's running around and I lose track of her briefly. Now, the great thing about this is that Zora walks around our church like she's perpetually at a family gathering. So all I have to do is look for the adults built down, bent over, cooing at her, and I say, oh yeah, that's where she is. She'll be back here in a little bit. Or I look for the youth and children who've taken, her and herding her like a cat or something. And so I think it's for this reason I'm a bit sympathetic to Mary and Joseph here in this story, right? I can almost hear the tone in their voices at dinner time that first day, right? Mary is there setting plates out. Oh, hey, honey, can you go get Jesus? He needs to wash his hands before dinner. Get Jesus. I'll go over to your cousin's house. My cousin. No, he's not with my cousin. Remember, you said he was going to be with your parents. They were going to watch him today, and he could play with Jesse's kids. Jesse's kids. No, they can't watch Jesse's kids and Jesus. That's way too many kids. He was going to be with Elizabeth. And then they have this panic look where they both have the realization at the same point in time that Jesus is not with Mary's cousin and her son. He is not with Joseph's brother's kids, right? There's this frantic looking. They have to canvass everybody in the family. Maybe Jesus wandered to someone else's tent. He's in someone else's car. He's wanting to, eat his Uncle Larry's pie or something like that, right? But he's not anywhere like that. So now you've got to retrace your steps. So hopefully he's somewhere between the hotel and the temple and home. They keep searching and searching, and finally they come back to the Holy Temple. The temple in Jerusalem that day, it's not unlike churches across America this first Sunday after Christmas. All the travelers have loaded up their donkeys, they've taken their presents and ribbons, and they've headed home. The sanctuary is peaceful to the point that it's almost palpable. There's a little bit more elbow room in the pews. Those who worship in the sanctuary year-round have gathered together once again to talk about things that matter. And among them is the boy Jesus, engaging in conversation with the rabbis, participating in thoughtful conversation. Luke is the only gospel writer that gives us this story. It's not terribly surprising. Biographers in the ancient world, they weren't too concerned with people's personal lives. They were more focused on someone's professional accomplishments. So a story of a boy Jesus not appearing in Matthew or Mark or John, it's okay. But I love that Luke offers us this insight. Now, since we believe that Jesus was fully God, be easy for us to think that even as a toddler, Jesus displayed some divine power, right? Maybe as a toddler, he did low-grade miracles and multiplied his juice and crackers at snack time, or demonstrated the ability to see into the future, and so Mary had a terrible time planning surprise parties for baby Jesus or something like that. But this is not the impression that we get from Luke. Luke also shows us that Jesus was fully human. He, as he grew up, had moments of this dawning awareness that there was something different about his life, that he had a unique role to play in the world. In fact, by Luke's account, it will be another 18 years before Jesus is clear and certain in his calling as the Savior of the world. So for now, The boy Jesus is simply becoming aware that he has a unique relationship with God, one of father and son, and he needs to explore this identity further. This is the first step of Jesus of Nazareth's journey to become Jesus the Christ. And in the life of the church, we often refer to a scene like this as someone discovering their vocation. Vocation is a $5 word you can use at your next Bible study party. It comes from the Latin. It means summons or calling. It comes from this belief in the church that God calls every person uniquely and individually, equally, to use their gifts and their talents and their experiences to make the world a better place through Christian service and creativity and leadership. Now, a vocation is different from our job, from our work. Right? Our work is what we do to provide the resources necessary to survive. A vocation is what we do to discover meaning and to thrive. A vocation is always bigger than us and our individual needs. It's always connected to our relationship with God and with others. A vocation, and vocations in its broadest sense, it encompasses everything that makes us who we are, every role and relationship that we have in our lives, the roles we play at home and at work, at church and in the community. Being a parent is a vocation. Being a sibling, a boss or an employee, a church member, a citizen, these are all vocations through which we might express God's call to us to make the world better through love and service. Now, for some people, their vocation overlaps with their work. Right? The builder who finds purpose in creating homes for people, the teacher who finds meaning in educating young people. Now, other times, our work is what provides the resources necessary for us to pursue our vocation. The lawyer who finds greatest meaning in pro bono work, or the IT analyst who serves in our children's ministry. Your vocation can take many forms in life. But if it's first and foremost, if we call it a calling, then it must be about listening. The Christian writer Parker Palmer puts it this way. Before you tell your life what you intend to do with it, listen for what it intends to do with you. Before you tell your life what truths and values you have decided to live up to, let your life tell you what truths you embody, what values you represent. To discover meaning and purpose in life, we must first learn to listen to our lives speaking, learn to listen to God speaking into those lives. It's always a creative process. It depends what kind of creative person you are. For some people, learning about their vocation, their calling in life, or how their work helps them to find meaning, it starts with that left side of the brain in charts and graphs, right? And they map out strengths and weaknesses, and opportunities and threats. For other people, more right brain folks, it starts maybe with a gut feeling. Maybe a spirit of adventure, maybe a set of circumstances that come together at just the right point. But whatever form it takes, we are encouraged throughout the Bible to consider the unique direction God has for our lives, how we might have a special role to play in God's larger work of healing and hope in all the world. Now, I'll be honest with you. Right? Maybe you're here today and you have never thought of vocation in your life. Maybe you're here and you've had a break from work, but you're still thinking, how am I ever going to figure out what my vocation is with all the work I have to do? Perhaps wondering, maybe I have some vocations, but do they still fit? Does my work as a parent, does my work at my job, does this count somehow in this larger purpose? Well, take heart, if you have any questions about these matters, that Jesus in our story isn't clear on it either. His sense of calling in life doesn't work on a very clear, straight line. Later on in the Gospels, after Jesus has already started his public ministry, he'll still have moments where he's listening for God to clarify what he's supposed to be up to. Vocations evolve in our lives. The most important vocation I have in my life today is not pastor of this church. As much as I love that calling, my number one vocation is Zora's father. But 3 years ago, that wasn't the case. She didn't exist yet, right? And so in each season of our lives, in each year, we're constantly evolving and growing. And certain vocations take a prime spot of our time and energy, and sometimes they fall back. So we watch Jesus here on his own journey. We learn about our own. And at this early age, Jesus is beginning to get clarity, not on the full picture of what his vocation is going to be, not on everything that God is calling him to do, but just what are the essential elements of what God might be calling me to do in the world. One scholar writes about his response to Mary's question. Hidden in Jesus' response, but not to be missed, is his pronouncement of the necessity of what he was doing. I must be in my Father's house. The statement connotes an awareness of God's purposes that makes the fulfillment of certain activities imperative. Young Jesus doesn't know about the cross and the resurrection and the 12 disciples and all the different miracles. All he knows is that his life is intertwined with God's life, that his work will be part of what God is doing in the world, that if he's ever going to figure out what he's supposed to do in this world, he's got to be clear on who God is and what God is doing. Because that answer will also be his answer. And I love that in this passage, Jesus isn't the only one doing deep listening, if you notice that. Mary is also paying attention to things. Throughout Luke's gospel, Mary is portrayed to us as someone who has a sensitivity to God's experience, someone who tries to pay attention to when she sees God show up in her life. The way Luke describes it is that Mary treasured all these things in her heart. You'll hear this said of Mary multiple times throughout Luke's gospel. She is someone who doesn't just kind of go through the motions in life, doesn't pay attention or give second thought to something miraculous. She is someone who models this life of faith where she's constantly reflecting on what God is up to in the big ways and the small ways. And that this way of treasuring these experiences, it provides her insight for things that will happen ahead. I mean, our own lives, treasuring moments where we've seen God show up is important to sustaining us. Right? Remembering when God showed up in your life in the past, when a procedure went unexpectedly and delightfully well, when recovery went smoothly, when a relationship was repaired, when you thought that what was ahead was no way out, and suddenly, miraculously, you discover rescue. Remembering these moments and treasuring them, it gives us the stamina and the support in times when we experience that once again. Sometimes we draw this out of ourselves. We remember in a difficult moment how God has seen us through in the past. And other times we need other people to remind us of that. As a pastor once told me, sometimes I do the praying for someone else, and sometimes I need someone else to do the praying for me. So it's not by accident that Luke describes Jesus' early years as being formed by the rhythms and patterns of the community of faith. He tells us that when Jesus was born, Mary and Joseph took Jesus to the temple to be dedicated. That multiple times a year throughout his childhood, they would take the trip to Jerusalem to celebrate the holy days, that Jesus grew up in his hometown of Nazareth, worshiping weekly in the synagogue. Jesus doesn't begin to discover his identity, and Mary doesn't begin to discover what God is up to in her life alone on some mountaintop. That somehow Mary, unlike the rest of us, had some special divine sensitivity, and if only we had that, we could know what God was up to. She, like the rest of us, spends her life trying to recognize what God is doing. But their lives are held together by a community of faith that nurtures and supports them. They learn about God's activity in a loving community. And so we learn today that our journeys in every season of our lives to discover who God is calling us to be and what God is calling us to do is never a journey that we take alone. It's done in community with others and people who recognize gifts in us, who pray for us, who support us, who journey alongside us. Now, this was a lesson I saw embodied quite clearly in my time in seminary by one of my colleagues, Ellen Clark Clement. When I met Ellen at seminary, she was not like many of the other incoming students who were fresh from college, getting their first degrees. Ellen was coming from a 20-year tenure on Wall Street as a lawyer. She was making a career change. Her work in the past, her previous to first day of classes, had involved in advising her clients on corporate finance, securities and offerings, mergers and acquisitions. And she found her work on Wall Street exhilarating. Until one day she didn't. And all of a sudden she had this sense of emptiness, even in the midst of these canyons of power and money. Now, it didn't happen all at once. It actually began with what Ellen calls a small, inexplicable sense that I was being called elsewhere. God started showing up in my life every day in ways I could not ignore. I became curious. I attended church more often. I hungered for spiritual connection. And the more I connected, the hungrier I became. She began to spend more time and to find a deeper meaning in pro bono work, volunteering. She loved it so much that she would begin to sneak off at her lunch break and go serve lunch at the soup kitchen and come back to work with clients as she would devote weekends. And these experiences became more enriching, more filling, more challenging than anything that what she was doing for her well-paying clients at her firm. And during this process, She began to find encouragement from her friends, family, from pastors and leaders at her church. She said it felt like they began to see something emerging even before she could name it. They recognized there was a new calling in her life. So they encouraged her to go to seminary and to pursue ministry. And soon she decided to trust that small, inexplicable voice. And while she's grateful for her experiences and, honestly, her financial security during her time on Wall Street, she treasures even more now her experiences in ministry. Today, Ellen is an ordained Presbyterian minister. She ministers to churches across New Jersey in their times of transition by serving as an interim senior pastor. And this experience, this journey that she was on, it's taught her a lot about what vocation means for all of us. And for her, it's always tied to the way in which Jesus talks about discipleship in the Gospels. She writes this, you know, that's how Christ calls disciples, by leading us to love. Following God's call, loving the outcast, helping the brokenhearted, welcoming the stranger, we are transformed and find our true selves. As we approach a new year, I wonder if we might make 2019 a year in which we intentionally listen for our true selves, which we listen for God stirring something within us. That journey may lead us to affirm the roles and vocations we already have in our life. It may lead us to discover new ways of love and service that God is calling us to pursue. Every relationship, every job, every role that you have is a calling that is equally valuable to God. It's equally an expression of beauty in helping God build a better world. But identifying that calling, naming it and affirming it, this is part of our discipleship to Jesus. It's part of that life and life to the full that Jesus talks so much about. So I leave you with this quote from the great theologian and minister Howard Thurman. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that. What the world needs is more people who have come alive. May this next year be a year in which you go out and listen and discover that which makes you come alive, that which God has uniquely created you and only you to be and to do. And may you go out with the courage and perhaps just a bit of foolishness to go do that. For the world is in desperate need of people like you who have come alive, who will make new love and new hope and new peace and new joy and new justice come alive wherever you go. Amen.